So my attorney goes in there. She asked the bailiff. She's like, they vote him innocent. What is the procedure here? And the one spoke up. He says, well, you know, we'll just carry him back to the jail and process him out. And she says, no, I don't think so. She says, I'm going to go talk to the judge. I'll be back. So she went and talked to the judge and came back, and she said, the judge says if we find him innocent, he is to be released at that minute.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the story of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Hear the heartbreaking, true accounts of those who have been wrongly convicted and then are proven innocent. Thanks for joining us.
The judges, credit to them, they heard everything. They're unbiased. They have, you know, strong legal minds, and they had the courage to stand up for what, you know, they heard and were convinced of at the end of that hearing, is that we had proven that I was innocent.
In the previous episodes, Greg Taylor told the story of being convicted for a crime he did not commit. This bonus mini-episode will highlight some of the direct effects Greg's case had on shaping policy. And we get a bit more personal with stories about his experiences with his daughter. I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening.
All I am is just a human who's made mistakes and, you know, tried to correct those mistakes while I watch people of far more stature ignore their mistakes. The governor that, you know, was turning down so many clemencies while I was pursuing mine, he's the one with the felony on his record now.
Mike Easley became the first North Carolina governor to plead to a felony in October of 2009. He neither served prison time nor probation. He paid a $1,000 community penalty.
My original attorney. I'm the one without the record.
Jim Blackburn pled guilty to forgery, fraud, embezzlement, and obstruction of justice in November of 1993.
And we won't even talk about, or I'd like to talk about, if you've got time, about what happened to that crime lab. Yeah, so they went in North Carolina, the Forensic Sciences Act was a part of the fallout of my case, and with that act, there was a lot of reform that had to do with the state crime lab. And one of the things is you have to actually be a scientist.
The Forensic Sciences Act of 2011 established the Forensic Advisory Board, which developed protocols to decrease human error in forensic examinations and develop policies concerning the admission of forensic evidence into courts of law, and has determined that the State Department of Justice can exclusively hire certified professionals.
Before, they were sworn officers, so they believed that, you know, their job was not to simply test and report, but to convict. And now, I mean, they might not even be allowed to carry badges, the best I can remember, but the Forensic Science Act in North Carolina was a result of my case.
Greg's daughter, Kristen, was 9 when he was incarcerated.
You know, she was, the first thing I missed in prison was her 10th birthday. You missed all those Christmases and everything. And I missed her 16th birthday. And I missed her high school graduation. I missed her college graduation. I missed her marriage. I missed the birth of my first grandson. And, then by the time I get out, she's 26 years old. She's got her own family, and I go to live with her, and I have a $40 gate check. So that's the way it started out, but it was wonderful, absolutely. I would like to talk about her wedding just for a minute, if you don't mind. She would come to see me. She came with my wife a lot in the beginning, and then just a couple of times after my wife left. And I think the hard thing about it, that particular aspect of things for me, was that I felt like she was coming up there looking for a father. And here I was, just this mess of a person that, you know, really was just at that time, you know, just totally focused on just getting out. You know, I didn't know how to be anything else at that time. And so I felt like it would make the most sense to her if I just, you know, if she just went on with her life, you know, like I was, you know, not there. So I didn't see her for a lot of years. And when she was 18, you know, and I would write her and stuff. And she would write occasionally. But when she was 18, I sent her a birthday card. And I told her, it's not that I did not want to see you. I just didn't think I could see you. But, you know, so, but now it's your decision. You're 18. And, you know, and if you want to visit, you know, then that would be great. And she came up that weekend. And came up every chance after that, you know, when she would go off to college and come back and visit, she would always make the time to come up and see me. And you know, and then she gets this boyfriend and they get engaged and I keep thinking, well, okay, maybe they'll just like quietly go somewhere and get married, but she's talking about preachers and bridesmaids and dresses and stuff. And I was like, okay, well, you know, thinking to myself, who's going to walk her down the aisle? And I never had the courage to ask her that. Finally, the very last visit, right before she was going to get married a couple of days later, you know, we're sitting there talking and the visit was over and we both stood up to give our, you know, goodbye hug. And I looked at her, I said, Kristen, I said, how are you going to get down the aisle? And she looked at me and she says, I'm going down the aisle by myself. Then nobody can take your place.